Diversity, equity, and inclusion, also known as DEI, is a key initiative for many organizations. There are varying levels of efforts within organizations to achieve this, but certainly the words populate most company brochures, websites, and hiring practice literature. My question surrounding this initiative is, after taking specific actions, such as changing hiring practices, bringing in chief diversity officers, rewriting performance reviews, and establishing mentorship programs to address this issue, why has so little changed? What's another question that we should be asking? Today, I shall explore that with my special guest, licensed social worker and inclusion advocate, Elizabeth McCorvey.
Welcome to What's Another Question, where decision coaches, change agents, consultants, business transformation leaders, and you explore and gain insight into better questions for framing your thinking and guiding your actions. Here's your host, decision coach, expert facilitator, author of Asking is Better Than Telling, Catherine Rossback.
DEI is a topic that populates the pages of Harvard Business Review, HBR these days, and as preparation for today's interview, I did some digging as to when this topic began appearing in the magazine. By the way, I use article counts in HBR as it is the magazine that managers and leaders go to for a source of information, and thus reflects not only the topics of interest in organizations, but often ends up driving the next organizational initiative. So the first HBR article to explore inclusion dates back to 2012. Articles using the specific term DEI began around 2020 and exploded in 2022. Diversity made the cover in 2016. That, unfortunately, was about how most programs don't work. But there have been many articles before, mostly focusing on women. Those articles included Women in Management, Delusions of Progress, 2010, The Battle for Female Talent in Emerging Markets, that also was 2010, Stopping the Exodus of Women in Science, 2008, and my favorite article, Do Women Lack Ambition, 2014. Articles on racism and what leaders must do to address it graced the pages in June of 2020, undoubtedly as a result of the death of George Floyd in May of 2020. One would have guessed that with all of this information, there would have been remarkable progress. The articles sadly reflect otherwise. Why Diversity Programs Fail showed up in a July-August 2016 issue. The November-December 2020 HBR article entitled Getting Serious About Diversity and a DEI June 2022 article also reflect the lack of impact. In the latter article, the authors write, consider that since 1955, out of 1,800 CEOs in Fortune 500 companies, there have only been 22 Black chief executives. Presently, there are only 5 Black CEOs in the Fortune 500 companies. Similar issues can be observed in academia, medicine, and STEM. This systemic leadership gap makes it apparent that Black decision makers are still not seated at the table today, despite the call. Why has the needle moved so little? Using my question of questions, why does it make perfect sense? Why does it make perfect sense that despite so much effort, so little has changed? To what extent are organizations, and specifically leaders, asking the wrong questions of the wrong individuals? To explore this, I reached out to the African-American mental health therapist, Elizabeth McCorvey, who recently published in a 2020 Psychology Today issue on the topic of how to talk about race.
My name is Elizabeth McCorvey. My pronouns are she and her. I am a therapist and a social worker in Asheville, North Carolina. I have, three or four or five different hats that I wear. I work with college students at the University of North Carolina in Asheville. I work in the Health and Counseling Center, and I get to work with college students who are in need of therapy or some therapeutic support. I also see a couple clients through a doctor's office where I'm contracted. I am faculty at the Herd Institute, where I teach therapists how to partner with horses in order to support the healing of their clients. I have been certified in the EGALA model, the Equine Assisted Growth and Learning Association, the EGALA model for therapy since 2015. And so I've been working with horses and humans together in support of their healing for a long time. but now I get to teach other therapists how to do it. I see a few clients here and there on the side with equine-assisted psychotherapy, but my real passion is teaching other therapists how to do that work. I do a lot of anti-racism education. I am often contracted with other, primarily mental health organizations. That's my focus for therapists who really want to deepen their knowledge about how to bring anti-racist and more equitable practices into their work with clients and into their agencies and into office culture. So I'm really passionate about that. And I'm also a musician in like two or three bands. And so I stay pretty busy.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, given all of these different hats that you're wearing, for your time this morning. I'm very fascinated, of course, about how you've woven horses into your work. And for the listener, we met 10, 12 years ago at a horse show at the Kentucky Horse Park in Lexington, Kentucky. And we were both waiting for our turn to show jump. So we're sitting at the gate, you know, where the nerves are mounting and you're ready for your go. And I still remember this. I saw you and you were surrounded by the sea of white women. And I sat there wondering, I thought, what was that experience like for you? And then I came up, I believe, and introduced myself. And so we've remained connected, but I never asked you that question. So before we jump into this, what was that experience like for you? Just surrounded by all these white women and there was no other person of color.
So I'd been riding for quite a while at that point. And so I've never had an experience in riding where I wasn't surrounded by white women. So it felt pretty normal. I have a new friend, Aubriana Johnson, who is the founder of Black in the Saddle. And I was recently on her podcast, and she talks about how she's had the opposite experience where she grew up around Black horse people her whole life. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. I can't imagine. I can't imagine what that would have felt like. So to answer your question, it felt really normal. And there was never a time where I was not aware that I looked different than the other riders and the other people in that area.
That is amazing. And if we had more time, I'd ask, where was she riding your friend? Because every horse show, as I continue to stay in it, is always a sea of white people. You see some people of color, of ethnicity, but rarely. It's definitely a white sport in my mind. So we're going to be exploring inclusion today, which in my work as an organizational consultant, I always hear about in the various organizations, we want to be more inclusive. We want to be more diverse. And yet, in the 20-some years that I've been consulting, it doesn't seem like the needle has really moved that much. So this is the topic I wanted to explore with you today. And again, since the podcast name is What's Another Question, to seek some of your input on what are the questions that organizations, who I do believe, they state that goal in earnest, we want to be more inclusive and diverse, and yet their practices of trying to achieve that aren't moving the needle. So I want to explore with you some of the questions that they should be asking. And before we jump into this, can you give some of your current work to the extent that it involves this topic called inclusiveness or diversity?
Well, I engage in it pretty much constantly. Being a social worker is political. Being a therapist and supporting human rights and the needs of people is political. So there's never not a time in my therapy room, in my DEI consulting, in my work with the Herd Institute, which is really grounded in equity and inclusion. There's never a time where I'm not thinking about how systemic oppression and systems that marginalize people impact the folks that I'm working with.
I see. Well, let me jump in then with some insights. And I'm going to quote from a lot today from the Harvard Business Review, because that's a big management magazine that people read in the business world. So the first one I wanted to start out with, there was a February 17th HBR article. The authors wrote, and I'll quote here, "Leaders have long recognized that a diverse workforce of women, people of color, LGBT individuals confers a competitive advantage in terms of selling products or services to diverse end users." They write, "Yet a stark gap persists between recognizing the leadership behaviors that unlock this capability and actually practicing them." So starting out from a broad view, what would be your read on the practices that are missing?
Well, I think in regard to that quote, the answer might be in the question. So they're saying we've long regarded the importance of, and I'm paraphrasing here, we've long regarded the importance of having folks from diverse backgrounds in our workspaces when it comes to selling products. When I hear that, that makes me think of if the end goal of having a diverse workplace is for consumerism and marketing, then you're not actually trying to honor and include people. You're trying to use them for capital gain.
Fascinating and insightful read. Yes. So first is the questions that they're asking. What would be a question when you say they're asking the wrong question? What's a couple other questions that if we could rewrite the start of this article, should the questions be?
Well, I think the question isn't, why don't we have more women, LGBT people, et cetera? The question is, what has prevented us from having those people in the first place? What about our workplace practices prevents those folks from wanting to be here and prevents us from being able to retain them? I want to point out, too, that I think that this conversation that we're having, you mentioned that for the last, I think you said 20 years, you've been having these conversations and thinking about this. But really, it's since the inception of our country that we've been trying to answer these questions about how to make people feel more included. And we have not moved the needle for 400 years because people still do not feel included. They still do not feel welcome. And we're asking the same questions. You and I having this conversation. I've had this conversation this week, probably three or four times. And unless we're willing to create some really radical change, we're going to keep having to ask the same questions.
Yes, that's a perfect insight. Outstanding insight. So I want to dig into some of those practices and the questions again, because I do want to point out in most situations that there is an intent of how can we do this? What are we missing? So I wanted to go to describing the experiences of those African-Americans, people of color. In my work, I've had a good opportunity to talk with women. And one of the quotes that comes later in this article really resonated with me. And I hear this all the time. These articles write that 37% of African Americans and Hispanics and 45% of Asians say they need to compromise their authenticity. And they go on to write that an example of this is women in science, engineering, and technology, regardless of gender, acting like a man can provide an advantage in becoming a leader in these fields. And so I wanted to hear from you. To what extent does that resonate with you, that compromising their authenticity? And then secondly, what would be examples of compromising authenticity for an African-American?
Let me think about this. So I think that the phrasing of that question interests me because the onus is then put on marginalized people for shifting their behavior, when in fact the responsibility lies in the people of power for the expectation of a certain behavior in order to advance in the field. And that's something that happens to marginalized people constantly, is that we are given the responsibility of changing our behavior in order to fit into systems that do not welcome us, have not served us, and do not really want us there, except for the purposes of capital gain. And so then if I don't act a certain way, if I don't talk a certain way, then I am punished, when the onus really belongs to the people in power who have that expectation of me and that bias towards me, that if I don't do those things, then I'm the outsider. Because the ultimate goal in when companies and programs say that they want to do things differently and there's good intent, what I actually hear them saying is that they want to move the needle in tiny incremental ways that still allows them, the people in power, to feel comfortable. And if they're still comfortable, then there's not actual tangible change happening, because people have to be uncomfortable in order to make a change. People in power specifically have to be willing to be uncomfortable in a real way. They have to be willing to give up their power in a real and tangible way in order for there to be change. And there won't be change before that. In terms of compromising authenticity, I can't answer what that looks like for an African American person, because there's not one broad stroke.
Of course. Yes. Yes. Which I think gets into the something that I've heard, you know, we have the one woman on the committee, the one African-American on, and they feel like, I've got to speak for this entire group of people. Like we all think the same way, like we all act the same way. And I'm not going to carry that burden because I don't know how the other person thinks. So I love your response to the sense of compromising authenticity. That is so common. How do organizations address that? What do they need to do differently rather than the, hey, in fact, I just know of a company, they were starting up an inclusion group. And I thought, okay, great. They're going to populate it with, you know, women, people of color, LGBT, and who are now going to have to speak for the rest of the organization. What do organizations need to do differently to get past that? I'm going to speak for the entire group.
That's a really broad question. I think some of it lies in folks in leadership acknowledging their complicity in creating a system in the workplace that laid the foundation for that to happen. Because again, the onus doesn't belong to the individuals who are having to speak for their whole group. The onus lies in folks in power who continue to have the expectation that people, that marginalized people speak for everybody. And that's where people in power are going to have to give up some of their power and empower other people to take leadership positions so that there's a culture shift.
Okay. You've brought up some wonderful points, excellent points on how, you know, moving to this period of discomfort, which I always love, it kind of harks back to chaos theory that says systems won't change unless you go through that really messy period. And a lot of the times people get in that mess and they think it's going wrong. And so they go back to the old way. This can't be right because it's very messy. I'm very uncomfortable. I don't like this. How do you suggest somebody who's leading in an inclusion diversity effort, how do they help leadership, their organization, go through this messy period, which you pointed out? How do they help that transition?
Well, if they are uncomfortable with discomfort, then they probably are not qualified to be in that position of leadership, first of all.
Okay. That's a superb point. I know I've got several now who are going to be scratching their heads on that one going, huh, how am I with that? Great point. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. Please. Well, I hope they do. I hope they do scratch their heads because if they are not equipped to tolerate the discomfort, then they can't lead somebody else in tolerating the discomfort. Mm. And it's not fair for people who make less than them to have to bear the burden of being uncomfortable when the person in power also can't tolerate that, but makes much more than they do, especially in the system of capitalism. And when you talk about moving to this period of discomfort, that might be true for people who are in power, which are predominantly white cisgender men and women who have land ownership. So they might be uncomfortable, but marginalized people have been uncomfortable this entire time. So when they say, it's hard for us to move into this period of discomfort, they're really showing who they are. Because if they haven't been uncomfortable, they haven't been paying attention, and they haven't been serving the needs of their marginalized community. So again, the answer lies in the question. If they're uncomfortable for the first time, then that's a wake-up call that they haven't been doing the work.
Oh, fascinating. If you were brought into an organization who group of leaders is sitting in the room, and they say, okay, we own up to this. We've got to start. It's not what somebody else needs to do, but what we have to do differently. How would you begin that conversation? What would you ask of that leadership group?
I would wonder what their experience with discomfort and diversity and equity inclusion has been before. Because it's not only the expectation that they shift things in their work life, because if it only happens in your work life, then it's hollow and it's performative. But what I'm curious about is people's social circles where people frequent, because if the only time they interact with conversations about diversity, equity, inclusion is in the workplace, then they are doing themselves a disservice, first of all. But if you aren't shifting the community that you're living in and interacting in, you're never going to have the opportunity to be uncomfortable. And then you're never going to have the opportunity to change.
That's fascinating. It's fascinating to me because one of the things that popped into mind is the first thing I see in inclusion and diversity, and I've seen this in so many organizations with women, we're going to have a women's network. and all the women are going to get together. And so we're going to have a people of color network or whatever. And so when I put that action, which is often taken, I think, okay, great. There was no change in the community. We just put them off by themselves. And with this recognition of this, let's form this network. Does that resonate with you? That creating inclusion and diversity, you're in fact solidifying the fact that we're going to remain separate.
Well, in a way, I understand the need for affinity groups, people being able to talk freely with people that look like them, who have similar life experiences as they do. And sometimes subcommittees, work groups are created as a way to neuter the requests of marginalized people. I can't tell you how many times I've been in board meetings or workplace practices that say, oh yeah, we're going to create a DEI subcommittee to talk about it, which means that no decisions are going to be made in the next 2 or 3 years. And all of the decisions have to be run by a group in power who isn't participating in that work and therefore doesn't understand the depth and the need for it.
So where do you go next with this group of leaders sitting in front of you? You've asked the question about their past experiences, how they see it. How do you weave those experiences into moving forward?
Well, so I'm a therapist, so we could spend a year on what it feels like to receive the question, is your entire social circle white, cis, het, able-bodied?
Okay.
So, and when we talk about change, we're talking about, if we're talking about sustainable change and workplace culture change that is long-term and lasting, then we're talking about years of conversations and years of doing things differently. This isn't just a couple meetings where we talk about DEI initiatives and put them in place. This is a deep, deep uprooting of acknowledging and shifting the practices that have kept people in power comfortable for a very long time. And that takes a long time.
To lead that effort, in your opinion, what is the background, I guess, and knowledge of the people who are leading this effort? And if there is a group pulled together to address this, who are those that, if you were looking to build your team, who would you look for? Who would you want to have on your team with you? And would you be the kind of person to lead it, I guess, is another question.
It depends on where I am in the company. I would want the group to be comprised of people who are most impacted by any company's decisions. I want to talk to the people who are on the ground, who make the least amount of money, who are the most exploited, because they have the wisdom to let us know what is not working.
And what about populating it also with having white men on the team? Someone who might be in a position of power.
I mean, I think that's where it gets a little complicated, because is the assumption then that there aren't any white men who are on the ground level?
Okay. Thank you for that. Okay.
So I think that it has to be interdisciplinary, and there has to be a perspective of power sharing that happens where even though the CEO is in the room, they are able to recognize that if they want sustainable change, they have to step back and let people who are impacted lead. And you have to pay those people, because if you're already in a marginalized position, then it is only a drain to have to teach people how to treat you. And that wisdom deserves to be compensated.
Fascinating insight. What would this look like? Often in my work, a lot of my work is when I say, we want to do something. And I say, great. What would that look like? How would we know this has been achieved? By what measures? What are our objectives? How would we know we've succeeded with this? I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
I think that probably looks different for every organization. Because if every organization is going to have different levels of need and different levels of marginalization, different levels of exploitation. I think my sense is that what it probably looks like is that people who are on the margin and everyone, because if you help the lowest person on the spectrum, you're helping everybody, is that those people don't feel exploited, that those people feel valued, that they feel included, that they not only have a seat at the table, but when they speak, their voice is heard, that they feel like when they bring up issues, those issues are honored, And that they are as capable of making tangible change as the person at the top who makes the most. But also, probably when it comes to dismantling systems of oppression, we have to talk about creating a more level power field rather than having somebody at the top and somebody at the bottom, because everybody has wisdom and expertise that goes into their role that is valuable. And it's not equitable to say that somebody at the top makes more because they have more knowledge, and that they're, because then that inherently makes them more powerful.
Yes.
And more. But the fact is, if they can't do their job without the people that are being paid the least, then they are maybe not necessarily deserving of that amount of power.
Yes. Superb points there. So with that, when I look at some other research and preparing for our discussion here, was looking at what organizations are doing in this realm so we could talk about specifics. And one of the research articles looked at how the employee conversation needs to change, that conversations between a leader and their employee need to be more conversational rather than, you know, the edict from above. In this discussion, they also talked about how organizations are putting emphasis on stop talking and start to listen. So I'd like to explore that with you. If a leader was saying, hey, I'd like to go out, I'd like to learn to listen differently, what would be your counsel for that leader?
If someone said, I'd like to learn to listen differently, I would wonder how they're listening currently.
Okay.
I would want to know what information are they getting that's letting them know that they are not listening. What's their reaction when someone reflects to them that they don't feel heard? And I would be curious by people who are impacted by that person, what their sense is of that leader. And I would defer to the opinions of the people who they are in charge of.
I see.
But that's tough because you can't, because of the power dynamic, it is intensely difficult for people who are in lower socioeconomic statuses on the workforce to be honest with their leaders about what they're missing, because their job might be in danger. In North Carolina, for example, it's a will to work state, which means that someone can be fired for no reason at all. So you're not always going to be able to get honest feedback if people feel like their livelihood is threatened.
I'd like to turn to the topic, sometimes very inflammatory, the topic of racism. It was interesting to me, there was a June 2020 HBR article. It was entitled, "The U.S. Businesses Must Take Meaningful Action Against Racism." And they wrote, "While conventional diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives focus on employee engagement and belonging, today's challenges reach far beyond marginalization in the workplace. We now see and hear Black people who are suffering from the weight of dehumanizing injustice and the open wound of racism that has been festering for centuries." In this article, they also pointed out that many managers would like to perhaps explore this, but they don't have the skills. And as I read this, I thought about the article that you wrote, where you explored mm-hmm. how to have this conversation, and it generated, I recall, a lot of interest. Could you tell a little mm-hmm. bit about the article and some of the main points that you explored?
So that article I wrote in 2020 after George Floyd was murdered, and it was specifically aimed at therapists, although I think that it could be broadly used by anybody wanting to have a conversation about race, about how to initiate that conversation with folks. And I gave folks really directive advice about how to approach the conversation, what they could say, what was advised not to say. I was inviting people to lean into the discomfort and the awkwardness and perhaps saying, you know, we've never talked about race before, but I want to know how this is impacting you. I want you to know that I'm committed to doing my own work around race and racism in order to understand your experience, and I'm here to honor yours. I recently, earlier this year, I updated that article to reflect what I believe about folks in power seeking to have these conversations. And again, it's specifically directed at therapists, but the more I do this work, the more I am passionate about the notion that if you are not prepared to talk about race and racism, if you're not prepared to talk about transphobia and ableism, then you are actually not qualified to be in any kind of leadership role. If you're not prepared to talk about these things, you are simply not qualified.
Powerful. Powerful. What's the thinking process that's led to this?
Because of the ways that marginalized people's lives are at stake when white, cishet abled people in power do not see them as full beings. People are dying because of the systemic nature, the pervasive nature of the way that racism, marginalization, systems of oppression impact marginalized people. So if you're not qualified to, if you're not able to talk about these conversations freely, if you're not able to have these conversations freely, if you're not able to talk about how race and racism in your workplace impacts your communities of color in your workplace, then you're not qualified to lead them. Mm. That's not to say that only people of color can lead. That's not to say that at all. I know a lot of really, really powerful, amazing, thoughtful, creative white people in power who are doing really excellent work. And it's because they continue to explore the impact of whiteness on communities of color. It's because they continue to explore how systems of oppression impact marginalized people. And it's because they continue to unpack their own learning of our culture and what's expected of our culture and how that negatively impacts and sometimes lethally impacts communities of color, trans communities, communities who are in different religions.
I was just reflecting and listening for that that comment about unpacking their own perspective on that, because I've heard throughout this our conversation that that's just a critical theme. It's not looking outward. Our first step is looking inward, because if you can't do that and be okay in discomfort, then all of the other outward actions will fail to change the system. How could that manager who wants to proceed and understand how they can, he or she can, better navigate this conversation, where can they go for that article that you've written and updated?
It's on my website, elizabethmccorvey.com, ElizabethMccorvey.com/resources, I believe.
Okay, super. So just to give a high level then some specifics, what do the managers need to keep in mind to when they sit down to have this conversation? What do they need to keep in mind when it comes to racism?
If they've never had a conversation about race and racism before, if this is new for them, then they maybe need to have, they need to prepare to have their worldview shaken up. And they need to prepare to approach the conversation with humility and acknowledgement that they do not have all of the tools to engage in this conversation beyond listening. And they need to acknowledge that even though they have had one experience living in this country, in this world, in this culture, it is not the only one. And even if they hear something that counteracts their worldview, my expectation is that they consider that even if they don't share that worldview, that doesn't make the other person's worldview any less valid and valuable. We have to honor the experiences of other people, even when it doesn't match our own.
When you say they're not prepared, how else do they become better prepared for these conversations?
The information about how to engage in these conversations has been out there for a long time. I mentioned earlier that this conversation has been happening for hundreds of years, and I truly mean that.
Yeah.
If you go back to what Frederick Douglass wrote, he was right. The same things that he was writing are happening today. We have not shifted at all. We have shifted in some ways, but the major themes are still there. So we haven't erased racism. We've just shifted it.
Yes. Okay.
And so I would invite people to, there's so much literature out there. There are so many books. There's so many podcasts. There's so many resources specifically for workplaces. I'm thinking about the Attaway Group is a group that used to be local, but created by Desiree Attaway, but I think she moved to Durham. Anyway, they are constantly offering seminars, webinars, teaching opportunities, consulting opportunities for workplaces that want to learn how white culture impacts the workplace. I think actually it was maybe even last week they did a seminar called Whiteness at Work. It goes into how workplace culture is impacted by white supremacy and how systems of oppression manifest in workplaces. So that's a really tangible step that somebody could take action on right now.
Yes.
They could go to the Attaway Group website and find that training. I believe it's free, or it was free for a period of time. But also you have to invest. So
yes,
it's worth investing in. It is available. It's out there. If you want to learn how to dismantle systems of oppression in your workplace and acknowledge where they come from, you can do that right now.
Okay.
So no excuses.
No excuses, right. Elizabeth, this has just been, it's been such a powerful conversation. And in so many ways, and I will say personally, you know, hopefully I'm hoping that those who are listening also are, their world is getting shaken up, and the questions are flowing in their head, which again, your conversations, your comments, your responses are just, even myself, I'm going, I am asking all the wrong questions. Yes, I want to go do my homework and then I'll come back with better questions the next time we talk, Elizabeth. But what comes to mind in terms of just some last thoughts to leave the listeners with before we conclude this conversation?
I think something you said made me think about, there's this quote, and I don't know who it's by, I need to look it up, but it says, the first best time to plant a tree was 40 years ago. The second best time is now. And I think that that applies to this conversation. The first best time to consider race and racism, systems of oppression in the workplace was, you know, 200 years ago. And the second best time is right now. It's not too late to start having these conversations. And you are capable of starting right now.
Thank you so much for the gift of your time. This has truly been a gift. Really appreciate your time, and hoping people just don't go nod and go on, but ask, okay, what are the different questions that I need to be asking? What do I need to do differently? So thank you. A very, very powerful conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you.
This conversation with Elizabeth provided a profound learning experience for me. Nothing like taking a dose of my own medicine. I hope it had the same impact on you. I also hope that it was an experience that disturbed you, that made you uncomfortable, that you question how you approach inclusion, how your actions preserve that very thing you seek to change, and how you are asking the wrong questions to the wrong person. After the conversation with Elizabeth, I did a bit more digging into HBR and came across an article entitled, Women in the Executive Suite Correlate to High Profits. I sent this over to Elizabeth and she responded, I wish the article was titled, Having Female Representation is a Necessity in Any Workplace, Whether or Not Having Them Makes You More Money, or How to Value Women in the Workplace Beyond Financial Gain. In our next episode, I will be exploring inclusion and how everyday language practices create and sustain patterns of exclusion despite your best attempt. I'll be talking with Dr. Felicia Roberts, Professor of Communication at Purdue University. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening to What's Another Question with Katherine Rossback. This podcast is supported by listeners like you. We appreciate your support. Have another question you'd like to explore? Please visit our website at katherinerossback.com to leave a rating and review, send us an email, check out our workshops, and review our other publications and offerings. See you next time on What's Another Question with Katherine Rossback.